Rock 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty. Game on, weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Thanks to the two Johnnies, it's Monday the 4th of April and this is Game On. Coming up today, Paul Corrie and Stephen Kelly on a weekend where a lot of Irish players scored a lot of important goals.
But Benny hits it! Oh boy, does he hit it! He's having the time of his life at the moment on the international stage and now on the Wembley stage.
Keane Tracy's in studio to begin our build-up to the return of European club rugby after a mixed weekend for the Irish in action. In GAA, we have a strategic plan to pick through, plus Niall Moran and Barry Cahill on the Allianz League deciders.
Tony Brosnan sending it up towards David Clifford again. Corrigo O'Hara glued to 20 metres in from the sideline. Past the 13. Still David Clifford. David Clifford back on the net. Oh, beautiful David Clifford. That is a goal and a half. He took on the Mayo defence and he rattled the back of the net. Unstoppable. Unquenchable. What can you say about David Clifford?
All that, plus we have copies of FIFA 2022 to give away all week. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Welcome along. Paul Corrie and Keane Tracy are with me in studio to pick through a very busy weekend of sport. Keane, you made it back from France?
I did. It was Toulouse is a nice place. Pity about the result for the Ireland women. It was a tough day at the office, but yeah, made it back in one piece. Like I was saying when we were chatting on Friday's show, I landed in Paris on Friday in a blizzard, but thankfully the sun came out by the end of it in Toulouse.
So much sympathy for you heading to France for your work. Paul, did you get up to anything?
Not too much. I was actually at Darrow Breen on Friday evening and then book a load of football over the weekend, so probably OD'd on it at one stage.
Yeah, there was a lot of interesting sports results, I thought, at the weekend, and so much to get stuck into, especially from a Gaelic football point of view, because we're looking ahead to championship now and we had league finals in both hurling and football. But from a soccer point of view, there wasn't really any surprise, really, Paul, when you think about the Liverpool-Man City title race continuing as expected, with neither of them making any mistakes.
Nah, it was pretty much a foregone conclusion before the weekend took place. When you look at the teams that they were playing against, Burnley obviously struggling massively, City in great form, and similarly with Watford and Liverpool. So very much business as usual for both of those sides. I think for the two of them was probably a case of just getting through unscathed, make sure that they keep their important players fit heading into this Champions League midweek fixture. And then obviously it all comes to a boil next weekend when they meet in the league. And what a massive game that's going to be, Marie, because on current form they don't really look like, particularly Man City and their running, they're not going to drop too many points between now and the end of the season. And if they were to win that game against Liverpool in the Etihad, you would probably suspect that they go on and win from there. Liverpool, on the other hand, probably a bit more of a difficult run in on paper. They're probably not playing as well as Man City, but that probably bodes quite well for them because they're winning a hell of a lot of games and they just have that momentum and confidence about them. They have so many options now in the final third that they can chop and change it if it isn't working. But yeah, business as usual for those two, and it just sets it up perfectly for next week.
Stephen Kelly is with us as well. Stephen, as Paul said there, it sets it up perfectly for next weekend.
Oh, amazing. Honestly, it's what you were hoping for, wasn't it? That they're both going into this game still with the same gap between them, all to play for, and I suppose both of them feeling like it's in their hands, which is a funny one considering there's two teams that feel the same way. But it is, it's just an unbelievable game, and then to think that they have each other again so closely in the FA Cup, both teams just pushing and pushing. And even Liverpool, like you watch them, Watford had a couple of chances and it was that convincing, but they just get the results, they get things done, they get the job done. And I just kind of find that extra incentive for Liverpool would be winning the league in front of their actual fans, where it didn't happen last time. COVID prevented all that, so it's a little bit more of an incentive to try and get it done with everybody around them. So it just makes for an unbelievable end to the season.
Yeah, it does. It's complicated a little bit though by the Champions League, Paul, because by the end of this week things could be looking different for either team, just given the fact that there's so much demands on the players.
Yeah, there are. I'm not sure that either side are going to have too many problems getting into the next round. I know Atleti knocked Manchester United out, but they weren't convincing in that display. Of course, they will make it difficult for Man City, and Simeone's sides are always nearly mentally and physically draining when you play them over two legs. But you would suspect that Man City will have too much. They'll kill them with the ball. They'll create enough chances and they'll open them up and go through. And you would just suspect that Liverpool do similarly with Benfica. It's probably when you get to the next round that it might start to take its toll. Man City probably have a bit more of a difficult route playing, you would like to hope, at least I would anyway, Chelsea. Chelsea should go through against Real Madrid.
Did you not see the game at the weekend?
Yeah. We'll just ignore that one. You know, Spanish football isn't as strong as it used to be. So I think Man City play Chelsea, and that two-legged game could be quite draining, could be quite taxing. And it's when you follow that up with a Premier League game that you could be susceptible to dropping points, whereas Liverpool, I know, it's still a hard draw, but it's maybe the easier of the two. So of course those games, and we have seen Champions League sides drop points when they try to have that quick return to the Premier League, but at this moment in time it's hard to just see either side not winning a game of football.
Yeah, well, that is actually a really good point. It was interesting just to see Pep Guardiola, Stephen, today talking to the media. I know he was quite relaxed. He didn't do his usual build-up of the opposition manager. Instead, he was having jokes saying that he's definitely going to overthink his tactics for that game.
Yeah, no, it is a funny one. I think that's there's not many things you can question Pep Guardiola on. I think that's the one thing that everybody has, because in games, it's the Tottenham game springs to mind, and then, you know, and you think what he's done and changed the system at Chelsea as well, you feel that just he overthinks that, and you kind of think, for a manager of his quality, is that even possible? Like, he seems to take everything into account, and all those players and the way they play, and they don't seem to often change the way they play. So it's quite funny he's trying to bat that away straight away, because that's the question when they get to the stage of the Champions League. That's the question that's going to be thrown at them. Is it going to be you that changes something drastically or puts a player in a position that you haven't done before that makes a difference? Because on paper and the way City play, like Paul said, you just can't see them not win the game. And it begs the question, like, between now and the rest of the season, who can beat them? And it's only themselves, really, when you look at it.
Yeah.
So it's that's why the question's been posed at him, and it's an interesting coming back. But you can see he's starting already to the mind games, just to try and get that one off his back straight away.
I think that is a good point, Marie. I think if Man City are at their best at this moment in time, they're the best team in Europe, and if they can just produce and perform, even Liverpool I don't think will prevent them from winning the Champions League. But it is those decisions that have cost them. Mm-hmm. There was one against Lyon where he played five at the back. They'd never played five at the back in the Champions League final last year. I think it's the only game to date that he's not played Rodri or Fernandinho, and you would say that if it wasn't for those two decisions and the Tottenham one that Steve mentioned, they would have won at least one Champions League.
Yeah, and like as Stephen made the point there, even just saying it now, it's out there, so he has that awareness that he's the one that caused the defeat, really, because as you said, Paul, too, that the only team last year that could beat them was themselves, and they managed to do it. For anyone who was watching Peaky Blinders last night, it was a bit similar to that. So Stephen, look, let's move on to the other games and away from Liverpool and Manchester City, because Manchester United were also in action, and again just another disappointing performance.
It was you know, this is just seems it's a common theme. I'm just glad Alan isn't on here, because we're having a rant for 10 minutes about him, and Ruby have to listen to
him. He's actually on holidays, and I think he needed a holiday just to take a break from ranting about Manchester United.
He does, yeah, and Ruby needs one from him as well, I think. Stop listening to it. It's the same thing, isn't it? And, you know, you look at De Gea pulls off an unbelievable couple of saves. They get away one with the tackle, McTominay. At times they can be great, at times they can be poor. They just never look settled, they never look convincing all the time, and it's the level of consistency that consistency is a word that all we talk about with United, because they just don't have it. And a draw against Leicester, who have been really mediocre this season. Mm-hmm. They've been way off it. They've been so far off what their expectations would have been for the last few seasons, nowhere near the top four. Poor results, and just, you know, I know they've had been absolutely littered with injuries, and that's affected them, but it's not the Leicester that we've known in the last few seasons that have been taking points off teams, and you've been worried about, you know, it should have been comfortably gone into that game with the players they have at their disposal and won it, but they didn't. And, you know, they got thanked the goalkeeper for a couple of fine saves, and VAR as well for getting them away with it. So it's just another disappointing result. And, you know, roll on the summer and what changes are going to be made, because it's going to be absolutely fascinating to see the turn this club takes with the manager in the summer.
And it's again seems to be Marcus Rashford who's the story after this game. And Ranić, of course, asked about him and said that he needs to challenge himself and rebuild his game. Like, are comments like that helpful?
I mean, it's clear as day that he's not in his plans going forward. Yeah. You know, like, they didn't start with any striker. Fernandes as kind of that false nine absolutely does not work. And if Ronaldo was fit, Ronaldo, of course, would have set up in that way, shape and form. So the writing's on the wall for Rashford, as far as I can see, as long as Rangnick has some sort of say in how that team sets up. But the game itself was just littered with mistakes from both sides, and the quality was so low. And I thought Manu got out of jail. McTominay's was a clear as day a red card, as you're going to see. And I personally didn't think the Varane one was a foul. I'm sure Manchester United fans would disagree, but I think when you slow it down, it probably exaggerates the movement. And in open play and to the naked eye, for me, it wasn't a free kick. But for a number of those players, Marie, you look at Lingard, Pogba, Rashford, there's a number of those players that'll be out the door in the next transfer window. And for some of them, they need a fresh start.
Yeah, it all just feels a little bit painful, Stephen, just watching it and kind of watching it not going the way anybody wants it to go. The players, Ranić, the fans, anyone. And it's just limping along.
Apart from yourself, I mean, you're a Liverpool fan. It's gone exactly how you wanted to go for them, though.
Well, yeah, it was apart from all of the ABUs.
Yeah. But no, it is, and it's funny because we talk about it, and we still have this mindset. It's Manchester United, it shouldn't happen, but we should be past that by now, because it's been happening for a long time. Mm. It's been a long time in the making. They've not produced, like, they've not won trophies. They've not been really competing. And you look at Liverpool and City, and you're kind of talking, you all might think Manchester United, you think Premier League. They are nowhere near that. They are nowhere near City, Liverpool. Chelsea are miles ahead of them. Tottenham are ahead of them in the way they play at the moment. Arsenal are ahead of them in their consistency. So you're going to just think it's been a long time coming, and they've been so gradually just getting worse and worse, but not without making big signings, big deals, big players, and it's just not working. So there's a lot going on there that needs to be rectified to get them back on track. Of course they can. They're still a massive, massive club with a ridiculous budget, and what they're paying the players is astronomical, so they should be still within it. But it's not working with the shape of the players, with the players and the attitudes. You know, Maguire, he's just been £80 million player, and he's been nowhere near of late. So it's just been a load of really poor performances, and players have to look within themselves to think if they're doing enough for that club, and they're not.
Yeah, and like as we said at the start, it's just ongoing now, like the same story, different week. Paul, time to move on to Chelsea now. Like, where do you think they can go from here? Like, can they get things back on track? It was such a comprehensive defeat at the weekend to Brentford.
Yeah, I mean, the league is well out of reach, and has been for a number of weeks and months at this point. But at the point that, as a Chelsea fan, you would look at it, it doesn't bode well heading into the Champions League. And they went with a four at the back in the weekend, Marie, and they just haven't got the legs, particularly as a flat back forward. Azpilicueta right back, Alonso's left back, and Silva, who had a quick turnaround from international duty, they got exposed, really badly exposed. And having gone 1-0 up, you kind of thought that, yeah, this is looking good, and the next kind of 10, 15, 20 minutes were disastrous. A number of poor performances around the park, and to be fair to Brentford, they capitalised on it. I thought Christian Eriksen was superb. He really, really was. And if you look at the goals in the international break that he scored, he topped it up again on the weekend. A really good finish, and he was very instrumental in much of what was good. Ivan Toney and himself and Mbeumo were a real threat going forward, and it was a massive result for Brentford. And you would imagine that there'll be a queue of clubs. I'd like to hear from Stephen, you know, if Tottenham would go in for Eriksen again, because he looks as if he's back to that sort of form that he showed at Tottenham, and he's certainly going to be at the top of a number of clubs' lists. But from a Chelsea point of view, it doesn't bode well going to Champions League. Havertz missed a number of chances in the second half. Werner just still looks way off it. And when Chelsea are poor, their game is so slow, they look so predictable. And that has been the case for probably a number of weeks. Since the League Cup final, they haven't played well, Marie, and that would worry me going into the Champions League. But still have a bit of faith that they'll get past Real Madrid.
So they're in third, 59 points. Tottenham and Arsenal come behind, 54 points, and finding form. But just from the Ericsson point of view there as well, Stephen, as well as performing from a football point of view, he offers so much from a leadership point of view as well, and you can see why so many clubs would want him.
Oh, you'd be absolutely dying to get your hands on him. Like, he's a superstar. He really is. He's an absolute phenomenal footballer, and he's done at every level. And I am very hopeful that Tottenham will go in for him, because I know Conte met him in the airport when he arrived, before he signed for Brentford. Didn't he had a conversation with him, had a coffee with him, and I'm kind of like, and hopefully he was planting the seeds there, just let you get through these 6 months, make sure, you know, you're back to what you are. And I think I absolutely could see him come calling. You know, Tottenham at the moment, they are playing really great football, and I think he could fit into that. And the fact that he worked with Conte in Inter and they won the league there, you know, it makes for a great story. But it's just, you know, I actually can't get my head around the fact that, you know, 10 months ago we were looking at this guy and we were all like gobsmacked, and you know, the pictures we were seeing, we were just in shock by it. And now he's literally ripping up trees on the international stage and in the Premier League again. It's phenomenal what he's doing. And he's, you know what? What's really interesting as well is that Brentford they've ripped up their playbook when they brought him in, because they have a money ball kind of system for a long time about players, buying young players, certain age, statistics, and a mold that they can resell them. Whereas Ericsson doesn't fit that. They signed him for 6 months, but they just brought him in because they knew his quality is more than enough to change their outgoing and how they can perform. So that for me is almost a big of a testament to his character and his ability, because a team that have just completely changed what they do when it comes to signings to get him in there, and to give him 6 months only as well, is amazing.
Yeah, well, it's certainly paid out off for them so far. Paul, Spurs' performance against Newcastle 5-1, and of course we're all looking at Matt Doherty and seeing him rejuvenated, and delighted to see him as well enjoying his football, happy, saying he always was going to stay anyway, and just getting the best out of himself.
Yeah, Spurs were excellent. They really were. And you know, listened to Conte after the game, and he said he's really enjoying watching his side play. And I guess much of that comes, particularly in that system, from those wing back roles. And Emerson Royale got one, Doherty got one, and Doherty set up Emerson Royale's chance as well, I think. So they've been really expansive. I think for Matt, it's been a really good couple of weeks getting himself back in the side. He's obviously a fundamental part of what Stephen Kenny does, and he looks really primed and fit. He's well able to get up and down in that system, which is very, very taxing on the body, because you've to join in attacks and then get yourself the whole way back to get into shape. But he's impacting the game in both boxes. You know, he's back to probably the form that he showed when he was at Wolves. He's then gone through a tricky time with Mourinho. I'm sure he would have thought that he'd be back in the team when Nuno got the job, and he's had to just bide his time, and he's had to hang in there. And that sometimes is quite a difficult job to do when you're in football. But having known Matt back to when he was a teenager, he never tends to get too high or too low, and that's probably a perfect mentality for a footballer. And I mean, the fruits of his hard work over the last number of weeks are really shown. I think he's got maybe 18 months left on his contract. I wouldn't be surprised if he was to get another one, and he was at the heart of much what was good for Tottenham yesterday, and they looked really, really good. You know, if they can produce that sort of performance on a consistent basis between now and the end of the season, it's going to be really tight between themselves and Arsenal.
Yeah, and that's it really, Stephen, isn't it? If they can produce that consistently, because it wasn't that long ago where they were struggling. There were so many questions about this team.
Oh, well, it was win-lose, I think, was it 8 games on a spin? It was unbelievable. You'd never seen it before. But then just before the international break, they got a couple of wins back-to-back and come back after now with a really great win. And it's just the way they play. At times, they're great to watch, and it's actually so nice for me to see, because some of the football they play, when you see Kane dropping deep in his passing, some running off him, and then the wing-backs, which are, you know, absolutely instrumental in the way Conte plays. And I just think for Matt, it's the shape, it's the style. And when he was playing full-back, he was playing right-back for Mourinho, that's not Matt's position. And being a fullback, it's, even though you think, oh, they must be very similar, they're not. They're very different positions. And Matt Troy of them was at his best when he was at Wolves playing in the wing back role. And at Tottenham now, he's back in that position again. He looks fit, he looks sharp, he's got energy to burn, and he's thriving in the system that they're playing. Not alone that, they brought in Romero, who I think just sturdies up that defence. And as a wing back, if you have, I know he played on the left side the weekend, but if you have a defender behind you that covers space, Davies is happy to cover the left back channel, so allows them to go forward a little bit more without thinking about the recovery runs. So I think that's really suited Matt and his style of play. But for Tottenham, It's great. It's really enjoyable for me. It's really enjoyable. And hopefully we can pip Arsenal. I'm not too sure. That's a massive game. The North London Derby as well when that comes around. But yeah, it's enjoyable. And Conte is, it's great to have a manager like that at the club who's thriving in the scenario at the moment.
Yeah, and it's actually just brilliant from an Irish football point of view as well to see him doing so well, because I think when he wasn't, everybody was so disappointed for him because he was so key to everything and is so key to what Stephen Kenny is about. But look, he's back on track now again. A team that are not on track, Paul Corrie, is Everton. They're losing to West Ham, and you'd have to think their relegation fears are very, very real right now.
Yeah, they are. And actually, it was probably one of their better performances of the season, and probably a little unlucky to go in 1-0 down at half-time with Charleston had two really good chances. And then you thought when Mason Holgate got the equaliser that potentially the game was there for them to go and take, or at least get something from. But the incidents that followed have kind of summed up their season. You know, the missed touch from Alex Iwobi was inexcusable. It was a really simple pass to control. He's taken his eye off the ball, and in the next kind of 5-10 seconds, Antonio's gone down. He's one-on-one with Pickford. It's a save from Pickford, and then it's a roll into the back of the net for Jarrod Bowen. And then what followed was just an absolutely ludicrous decision from Michael Keane, already on a yellow card, lunges in, down to 10 men, game over. And that probably sums up their last couple of weeks and months. There's just individual errors are costing them on a consistent basis, and when you're leaking goals like they are and they're not scoring kind of too fluidly, Richarlison and Dominic Calvert-Lewin haven't shown the form that they have maybe over the last 12-24 months. Calvert-Lewin, yes, of course, been injured, but even when he's been in, he doesn't look the same threat, and that would certainly give you the heebie-jeebies if you're an Everton fan. The one thing that I would say is I think the three teams below them are probably struggling equally as much, and if it wasn't for that, you would say they're probably in more trouble. I think they'll find enough points and enough performances that will keep them safe, but you would have to question then where does that leave them next season with Lampard. It doesn't really seem to have worked out quite the way they would have wanted, and where do they go from here? The owner seems to be in trouble similarly, like Abramovich, the club, the money they've spent. It just doesn't have that good feel at this moment.
Yeah, Stephen, it just doesn't seem to fit, does it?
No, not at all. Everton is so strange at the moment because they've spent so much money on players, mix match of players that just don't fit any sort of style or shape. And then you think, right, what do we do well? We get crossed in the box and we have two strikers that like to get in the box and cause people problems. And then when it drops, we have midfielders that can join in. And then you get rid of, which just seemed like the most crazy ludicrous decision, to let Rafa Benitez sell Lucas Digne, who was their highest assists. You know, Seamus Coleman was not going to be offering the same amount of forward play as he would have done before, just because that's what happens. That's nature. You get older and you just can't produce the same. So to get rid of that left back that was vital for them, it just seemed crazy when that was very much pivotal on how they played. And then to be in a position now where they are, you know, the game tomorrow against Burnley is just absolutely huge. Like, it's, and you know Burnley are absolutely thriving on that situation. They're going into that game thinking we can absolutely do this, we can get one over in these air mentality, as we've been here before, we fought, we know what's like. These guys don't have a clue what it's like to be in the situation and fighting for your lives. So but like Paul said, I think I don't know whether I'm being naive in saying I think they'll stay up because they've got more quality, because that's not always the case, but I have a feeling that Everton will have more than enough, because the teams that are below them, like Burnley playing against them, could pick up results. But you just feel that unless Burnley are playing the teams in and around them, they just don't have the quality to get the results against those teams anymore. And you think Everton, one of those players could step up and produce something for them. So you feel that they probably will be safe, but it's going to be a nervy, edgy final to the season for them.
Yeah, Premier League without them would be a very, very strange place indeed. Stephen Kelly, thank you so much for joining us. We're now going to turn our attention to the League of Ireland. There are two games tonight, Finn Harps and Drogheda United at Finn Park, kicking off at 8 o'clock. And UCD are hosting Derry City at the UCD Bowl. And John Kenny will set the scene for us.
Game on.
Football.
It's bottom versus top at the bowl tonight as UCD, winless so far in their return to the Premier, facing a Derry City side rejuvenated by manager Rory Higgins, and even at this early stage of the season must be considered as serious title contenders. This game is a rescheduled one from March the 11th when Belfield was waterlogged, so UCD come into this one with three draws so far and on the back of a 2-0 defeat at Dundalk on Friday, while Derry came from behind to snatch a late win at Bohemians to keep their place at the top of affairs in the Premier Division last Friday. UCD manager Andy Myler was less than impressed with his side's capitulation at Dundalk, saying for the first time this season he was genuinely miffed after a game. Myler, though, cannot expect any mercy from a Derry City side who are 3 points clear at the top and unbeaten in their 7 games to date. And it's a 7:45 kickoff at Belfield.
Now, Paul Carey is with me in a studio. That was John Kenny setting the scene for us. Paul, Derry City, 6 points advantage. When you think about the conversations we were having at the start of the season and the predictions made were that it would be very close between themselves and Shamrock Rovers, I don't think too many people would have thought that Derry would be, if they do win tonight, 6 points clear so early.
Yeah, it's certainly panning out that way, that the two sides that are going to be, I guess, leading the way. And for Derry, the nature of their wins over the last number of weeks, the late winner on Friday against mm-hmm. Bowes, they had a late winner against Shamrock Rovers as well, that's huge for them. You know, it gives belief in what it is they're doing, it gives confidence, momentum behind their side. And yeah, they've certainly got a bit more strength and depth about their squad now, Marie. Like, they were able to bring Patrick McElhenney off the bench, Akintunde and Matty Smith, three really strong players at that level, and that was able to change the game. And listen, it was probably a game where they would have taken a point from Dalymount, but to get out with three is just huge. And it's another test tonight. UCD obviously struggling down the bottom end of the league, but for Derry to go to Dublin on Friday, come back down again to Dublin again today, that's difficult on the body, it's difficult on the mind, but you would have to fancy them going into tonight's fixture. And if they could win tonight, 6 points ahead of Shamrock Rovers, that's a serious start for Roy Higgins.
Yeah, it really is. So that game kicks off at 7:45 in UCD Bowl. We're going to take a very quick break, but first I want to tell you about our FIFA 22 April comp. So Dublin artist Aix has teamed up with EA Sports to create an exclusive Dublin City kit for FIFA 22. Known for his murals and graffiti art, Aix moves from street to football by designing a unique kit bringing Dublin to life in-game. This limited edition vanity kit will be available in FIFA Ultimate Team from April 4th. To celebrate its release, we have a copy of FIFA 22 to give away each day this week. Not only that, but one of our 5 daily winners will get their own signed limited edition Aix City kit jersey. To be in with the chance to win today and get in the draw, all you have to do is answer the following question. Which team are currently top of the English Premier League? That's a bit tricky. Text your answer, your name and the name of your club to 51552. As always, RTE competition terms and conditions apply. See 2fm.ie for details.
RTE
2FM.
On
2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. It's time to talk Gaelic games, and RTÉ Sports' Damian Lawler is with me on the line. Damian, today was a strategic plan announcement from the GAA. Was there anything exciting in it?
I think, Marie, these strategic plans, they're very much looking to the future and trying to give a guideline or a roadmap.
That sounds like one of those words you'd use now for a strategic plan.
Yeah, there's a lot more jargonized words there than roadmap, I can assure you that. I had a good look through it. And look, to summarize everything, the integration process is the one, well, it's not the one, but it's one of the key findings that came out of Marie. Like, there's other stuff like watching games and monitoring Gaelic football and monitoring hurling and looking at the trends at the end of every season, sitting down as a review panel and seeing what changes, if any, are needed at those sports. So that will be interesting, like with all the talk about the tactics in hurling and mm-hmm. football. And at the moment, it'll be interesting to see how those sports evolve over the next 5 years. But today's strategic plan, really, even with the title is AINTIS 2026, is essentially together for the one road. It's all about integration, and the catch line was towards one GEA for all. So I think we're clearly driving in a direction anyway that probably we've been looking to get to for quite a while, and that will be the key newsworthy element that came out of today's report, Marie.
Yeah, and it is quite interesting that they have gone so strongly on it, because often with things like this, if we've seen in the past, it's almost a sit back, wait and see, and then, you know, if someone keeps pushing it or a body like the GPA keep pushing it, then react. But they're actually taking this head on, and it's there in black and white now to see that they're embracing it, which is pretty positive.
Yeah, we see at various times over the last decade, various presidents have tried to get in and get this sorted, but not everybody has wanted to move. It's as simple as that. Some units of the association might have felt they were at different phases than others. And, you know, that's been blunt about it. Like, not everybody has wanted to move. And it's you know, while it's got good traction at LGFA Congress and Camogie Congress and at General Congress, and it's been pushed hard by the GPA, you will have funnels down through the administrations that are happy enough to leave things as it lies. But I would say, like, the GAA are after kind of putting a little bit of pressure on themselves, really, with the, with the tagline of this report, APIS 2026. The plan is going to run over the next 5 years. So that's a bit of a timeline in itself. I always would have felt it would take a few years to implement a process like this. But effectively now what you're looking at here is trying to get all six codes in under the one umbrella. Six codes, one organisation, one association. And all throughout the strategic report, Marie, you know, the emphasis has been placed on unity and better together and stronger together. And that certainly was reflected during the COVID period, and I know we're still in the COVID period, but certainly the first 2 years of it. And I was on your show often enough talking about what GAA people were doing, and I think it's certainly effective now. But I think impressively enough in the report, like, they've broken it down into just more than words as well. So they're going to come up with a purpose-built shared vision that could actually unite everybody. And then, as we say, that word roadmap, that'll be designed to make it happen. And that's where the problems will start, and that's where the complications will be encountered. You have different administrations, different revenue streams, different outlooks, you know, different rules in their various sports, different communication strategies, probably different focal points. So they're all going to have to combine. But, like, at the end of the day, we are all in the Gaelic Games family, and I think the ethos is pretty similar. In terms of fixtures and administration and revenues, I think they'd be the three areas that will come under the greatest scrutiny, Marie, and get them boxed off to everybody's liking and identify a pathway forward for people to, you know, coexist under one umbrella. That won't be simple, and it won't be done quickly. But they have a general timeline there now, which leads me to believe that there will be more action. Public pressure will play a role here because everybody has put their hands up and said, we want this to happen. So I don't think the mood the public are in at the moment will let it slide back as it has done through the years.
Yeah, it seems to be firmly on the agenda, Damien. Yeah. I know you're tight for time, so I won't keep you too long, yeah. But I just want to say as well, I'm quite interested in the monitoring of the Gaelic football and hurling to guide future interventions geared towards improving playing standards, because that's quite reflective of what other big associations do. Like, FIFA have their technical department with Arsene Wenger, and they're constantly analysing the trends of the game and making sure that the different countries around the world are up to speed on the way the game is going. And Ian Tracy's with me as well. I'd imagine World Rugby do something quite similar, and if they feel that changes need to be made, they're quite reactive and proactive to making the changes. So it would be good to see the GAA adopt that as well, when there are so many people playing the games, all of the games as well. But we can discuss that another time, Damien, because we have a lot to get through. I will talk to you very, very soon.
All right, Marie.
Thanks so much. Cian, let's do move on to rugby, because a lot happened over the weekend, and I think we should start with the women's game and their pretty comprehensive loss to France. I know that we were talking about it last week, and you know, they were heading over there with the very little expectation on them, tiny little bit of hope that there'd be a bit of performance. And last week that kind of felt acceptable, but when I was watching it, I felt that it wasn't acceptable to see the Ireland women's team fall so far and just perform in such a disappointing manner, because, you know, you're comparing it to where they were just a few years ago and see where they are now, and it was just really frustrating.
Yeah, it was, Marie. It felt kind of similar to the performances that we saw last year that ultimately meant they didn't qualify for this year's World Cup. Now, you know, I feel like any conversation around the women's team, particularly when they're going to be playing teams like Wales, France and England, it's professionals against amateurs, and you ruthlessly saw that. France picked them apart. there's no shame in losing to that French team, particularly away from home, and no Irish women's team has ever beaten France on French soil, but it was the manner of the defeat, mm-hmm. I think, was really disappointing. 27 handling errors, a 44% success rate on their own line-out, 60% on their own scrum. So the set piece and the handling errors were just really, really poor. So they were always up against it, but they didn't make it easy on themselves at all. And, you know, they're playing Italy this weekend, and that's very different to when Italy come to town, when the men are playing them, because it's generally a case of, you know, improve your points difference for your title hopes. But this is a massive game for this Ireland women's team. Italy in the women's team, I would suggest, are far better than they are in the men's, if you know what I mean, in terms of level playing fields. Granted, Italy men's team did get that unbelievable win over Wales, but this is a huge test for this women's team. They have to win. If they don't win, they're going to be looking down the barrel of a potential wooden spoon, especially when you consider that the sevens players won't be there for the latter part of the mm-hmm. tournament, so they're starting team could be halved, really. So it's massive just to get a win on the board and take a bit of pressure off.
Sinead Kazan wrote a really revealing article today in the Irish Independent, and she was just pointing out a few home truths, just the fact that it's the first time in 15 years that Ireland have lost their opening two games. She's obviously highlighting the fact that they're amateurs, that they're working, and now they have another game against Italy, and they're only going into camp on Thursday. So you're talking about handling errors and the manner of their performance, and then you're looking at them heading into camp on Thursday, a lot of them having worked for all of the days that they've been at home, and you're wondering, where are they going to find the time to fix any of these?
Well, they don't have the time. That's the hard reality of it. There's fundamental issues here. Like I said, you're not going to fix your scrum and your lineup. You might be able to make subtle tweaks, but this is a long, long process. And I think, to be fair to Greg McWilliams, since he agreed to take on the job, he knows it's going to be a long process. And anyone who's expecting overnight success is just wrong, really. So patience is required. But the messaging from Greg McWilliams and the players is that, like, they don't want sympathy when they know they have to be patient, but really and truly supporters want to see a bit more progress, and they want to see wins on the board, particularly when you're playing Italy at home. And yeah, like I said, like, they'll go off today now. They're expected to do their recoveries on their own. They won't come back in until Thursday. And the reality is, like, the likes of England and France will be in camp all week preparing, you know, they'll be doing their reviews together. So by the time the coaches actually get the players in front of them even to do a review, it's Thursday and you're already looking towards the next game. So it's very, very difficult for this women's team.
And, like, we're using the words patience and process, and we're in an unfair fight even when we're thinking about them. And Sinead also highlighted Wales and just the fact that they brought in some professionalism, they had retainer contracts, and you see the knock-on effect that it's having on them and how much they've improved in such a short space of time. And we're comparing Ireland now, who have to go out and play Wales and England, and hopefully they will in time have more tests further afield. But every year that goes by, those teams are getting further and further away. So, like, we're having patience, but patience for what? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, is it patience for professional contracts, for retainers, or is it just patience that we hope we'll get to a stage where we're putting up a better challenge against France? Because you're not going to, amateurs maybe once every now and again are going to go out and beat a professional team, but you're not going to do it consistently.
Even in terms of covering the women's Six Nations at the moment, it's really tough because there's such a discrepancy between the teams, and like you said, the gap is only getting wider. And it wasn't that Wales, like, played this super impressive game plan against Ireland, but for me it was the conditioning of the players that was so much better, and you could see their fitness in the end really told. And that's just, like, Ireland are just not on a level playing field to that. So you're right, I think unless they do get some sort of contracts, they're going to be playing catch-up for a long time.
Big time. And you're looking at New Zealand then, and the Black Ferns announced today that Wayne Smith has
incredible
signed on as tech.
Yeah, I mean, like, that guy, like, would be, like, so highly in demand. Like, it's incredible for the Black Ferns to see that.
Now, and just to add to that, like, they haven't always treated their women at that level, but at least they're cottoning on now and realising that if they want to go and start contesting World Cups, that they need to have people of that calibre involved, and it's brilliant to see. Let's very quickly look at Munster and Leinster, and another disappointing weekend for Munster rugby, and again just kind of showing the gulf between the two sides.
Deja vu, really, isn't it? I think it's really important to highlight how well Leinster played. And, like, honestly, at times it was like watching Ireland, not just in terms of the personnel, but actually the style of play and what they were playing. They were so, so impressive. And the way they just seamlessly clicked back into gear, I think, was amazing, really. And I think Leinster are probably benefiting from the fact that I think now more than ever under Andy Farrell, Leinster and Ireland are far more aligned in what they're doing. You think of their messaging, like Stuart Lancaster worked with obviously Andy Farrell and Mike Catt, so there's so many similarities in terms of what both setups are asking of each other. Now, I know it helps when Leinster are providing some days like 12 of the 15 starting players, but even in terms of the tactics and stuff, Leinster are really reaping the rewards and they look seriously good going into the business end of the season. For Munster though, yeah, look, I think even the most diehard of Munster fans have just run out of patience now. It's just the same old stuff. Like, even they tried to play a little bit more rugby, which they'd been guilty of not doing in previous Leinster games, but the gulf is just so vast. You look at like Leinster's backline play, their starter play, it's just so, so slick, and they tore Munster asunder, I thought, with relative ease, if we're being honest about it. And the most damning thing I think about Munster at the moment is that if Johan van Graan hadn't invoked his release clause, he would be continuing as Munster head coach. I think it's been clear for a long time that Munster aren't really going anywhere under Johan van Graan. Lovely fella and all that he is, but like, this is professional sport, rootless business. And yeah, they look like they're just stagnating, really, to be honest. So it's amazing to think that he told them months ago that he was going to be leaving, and they still haven't announced a head coach. Now, it's firmly believed that it'll be Graham Rowntree, but the whole thing just seems really messy. And I think the sooner they get a clean slate, the better, because, yeah, they really need to move on. It's been a really disappointing era.
Yeah, and they have their European games this weekend, all of the provinces, so Connacht and Leinster in the sports ground, Toulouse and Ulster and Exeter Chiefs and Munster. And you're looking at the medical bulletins that come out on a Monday, and Leinster seems to be have a bit of an air of positivity around it, whereas Munster's is the opposite.
Yeah, like, I mean, Leinster didn't even have Johnny Sexton. They could have afforded to not play him last week. Now, to be fair, Munster were missing the likes of Tadhg Byrne, Sean Cline, Dave Kilcoyne and Andrew Conway. But even still, I just, like I said, it's essentially like going up against the Ireland team. And Connacht's got a big win for their season. I actually met the Connacht squad in the airport on Friday when they were flying to Treviso, and that was a much needed win for them. But you saw the damage, albeit that there was an early red card to Tom Daly a couple of weeks ago. But I would fear for Connacht over the two legs in the next 2 weeks, because, like I said, Leinster look like they're hitting form at the right time.
Okay, we're going to take a very quick break. We will be building up to all of those European games throughout the week. Stay with us. We'll be back very shortly to talk Gaelic games.
RTE
2FM.
Game on
2FM with Green Farm. Being up to 90 isn't real. The protein in our range is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back to Game On with me, Marie Crokey. Tracy is with me in studio. We are now turning our attention to Gaelic games, and former Dublin footballer Barry Cahill is with us on the line. Barry, we now know our Allianz Football League champions for 2022, Kerry, but everybody's talking about David Clifford.
Yeah, he was sensational yesterday. Unmarkable, really, in that form that he had in Croke Park. Now, in fairness, I think Mayo played into his hands. There wasn't any real sense of a defensive system there in place, or even double-teaming him at certain stages was something that they should have employed, particularly in the second half. But in fairness to him, look, he's an outstanding talent. We all know that for the last 4 or 5 years, and he's been incredible since he became a senior inter-county footballer with Kerry. And yeah, a lovely day in Croke Park from yesterday, weather-wise, pitch-wise, and you know, getting that good early ball into him, he's pretty much unmarkable, because he is, you know, he does have those great feet. He's well able to score on his size, etc. So there's no real weakness with him at the moment. And for anyone who's looking to stop Kerry, they're going to have to stop him.
So if we're just to put our crystal ball out here now, if they did meet Dublin in the latter stages of the championship, who would they be putting on him?
I think Dublin's best man marker is still Michael Fitzsimons. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of time for Mick Fitz. I think he's been outstanding and always, you know, manages to dilute the influence of the opposition's best players. So, but I don't think it's something you can do on your own. I think you do need a defensive system in place. You would have seen that during Jim Gavin's time, where they had the Philly McMahon, Keane O'Sullivan axis, and even with Johnny Cooper coming in. So I think if Dublin are to play Kerry, maybe potentially in an All-Ireland semi-final, they certainly will have to have a defensive system in place that they're very comfortable with to try and negate his behaviour. You're never going to nullify his effect in the game completely, but you know there are certain things he can do to try and make sure he doesn't have the impact. I mean, a big thing as well is in terms of the quality of the ball going into him. Like yesterday, there was very little pressure on the Kerry players out the pitch around the middle third, delivering good early quality ball into him. Whereas, you know, if you are playing an Ireland semi-final or a final, you'd expect a lot of pressure on those kicks going in, so they're not exactly landing perfectly into his chest.
If I was a coach now, I just love the challenge of trying to find ways to stop him. Probably be completely futile, but still, I think we forget as well, he's so young, he's probably really only coming into his prime at 23, is he? So you can imagine the what he's going to be capable over the next few years. We know what Kerry can do up front, and we've seen them in action, but it's their defence really that has got a lot of people talking as well. And it seems that Paddy Talley has had the effect, the desired effect on them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's long overdue at this stage that Kerry have a defensive system in place that will, you know, from their perspective, hopefully try and get them over the line this year. It has been a bit of an Achilles heel for them. They haven't quite replaced the personnel of, you know, an Aidan O'Mahony, a Mark O'Shea, you know, a Mike McCarthy from a few years ago. But in saying that, I think individually they have got that bit better. I mean, Thomas Sullivan is certainly one of the best man markers in the game, but I think it's that collective unit is something that obviously they've been working on over the last 3, 4, 5 months, and it seems to be something that all the players have bought into. And I think there's just a bit more meanness and a bit more steel to their defending as well. Opposition teams are made to work extremely, extremely hard to get a score. And I think that really wasn't the case maybe over the last 2, 3, 4 years when you see, you know, some of the scores that they conceded against Tyrone in the All-Ireland semi-final last year, and, you know, Cork in the Munster Championship the previous year, and even Dublin the previous year to that. So it was an area that required improvement, but certainly they're heading in the right direction in that sense.
So what's James Horan thinking this morning, do you think?
Yeah, look, he's going to be very disappointed. But in saying that, I think I mentioned last Monday, I wasn't overly sure that Mayo would be going all out on this game, given the fact that they have a massive Connacht Championship match against Galway in 3 weeks' time. So I wasn't surprised to see that the team was a little bit depleted. Maybe some of those absentee players wasn't forced, and maybe, but I think some of them weren't. So I think from his perspective, he's still got a huge amount out of the league. I don't think he'd be overly worried with yesterday's performance. You know, they're not going to meet Kerry again for another few weeks or few months further down the line, and I think for him he'll look at the positives from yesterday and certainly the areas for improvement. But again, it's a case of, you know, getting another game under the belt. Yes, it was a national final, but you know, I think the league is very, very important for a lot of teams at different stages. But you know, teams seem to move on quite quickly from the league as well and have an eye on championship, and that would be the case for Mayo.
Yeah, and I'd say that'll probably be the case for both Galway and Roscommon as well, just given the proximity to the championship.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, two teams who had already secured their promotion into Division 1, two teams that would like to see themselves there or thereabouts in All-Ireland quarterfinals and All-Ireland semi-finals come June, July time. So, again, it was a really good run out for both teams yesterday. Obviously, from Galway perspective, you know, scoring is never really an issue, and they only brought on Shane Walsh for the last 20 minutes. But defensively, they sort of remind me a little bit of Kerry in that I don't think they have the work done as a defensive unit to try and nullify opposition teams, particularly at that top level. You know, conceding 120 yesterday is never going to be enough to get over championship matches. You really got to be set up to concede maybe 14, 15 points in a game in the bigger matches against the better quality teams. So I think that's still an area of concern for Pádraig Joyce and his team, and that they don't quite have the individual personnel defenders-wise, so they need that system in place to try and put them in a position to win those bigger games. But certainly very impressed with Roscommon. You know, they've done a lot of great things over the last number of years in terms of promotion out of Division 2 and Connacht titles. And the big thing for them as well is they have a lot of scoring forwards up front of high quality. So, you know, they won't be fearing anyone over the next few weeks.
Barry Cahill, thank you so much. I think the next time we'll be chatting to you, we'll be talking championship. Time is flying.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking forward to it.
Thanks, Barry. Okay, it is time now to chat to Niall Moran about the Allianz hurling final at the weekend. Niall, it just feels like everything has aligned for Waterford. They have the right management, they have the right squad, they have the right game plan. It's all just fallen into place.
Yeah, it seems that way, Marie. I think Barry Cahill could have spoken about the league hurling final in the same way as about the football. I think cue the scoring that Kerry did, Waterford replicated it. I say David Clifford step in to Stephen Bennett. And again, I suppose the opposition will have huge concerns again over their defensive systems and the pressure that they put on the puck outs in this case. So if there was ever two finals that were copies of each other, I think definitely think Saturday and Sunday as well. But Waterford will be very pleased.
So we know now where Waterford are at, really, and I mean, on form, definitely the top team in the country. But where are Limerick then?
I think it's all about Waterford at the moment, Marie. I suppose, look, to be honest, like the conversation, first of all, is to go to Waterford. Look, again, like 420, 520 the last day, I think on average across the league, they're hitting about 31 points. And like if they hadn't conceded that soft goal at the end, like they're averaging nearly about 21 points concession. Like, okay, so with the exception of the game they drew against Dublin, like you could argue that they're winning all these games by between 6 to 9 points. Like, you know, so they are a good bit ahead of teams there at the moment. But I suppose, look, again, like on Saturday, like you'd have to have question marks over Cork. I thought Cork in terms of, again, I said it last week there, I just think their build-up play is just too lateral at times, and they're putting their forwards under pressure, and especially in a situation where they're two up front in the first half, the last day. And again, they were kind of trying to rotate forwards a little bit, and Conor Lehan coming out in a deep role. But I think probably what happened was guys forgot their primary responsibility in their own position, and maybe they needed to go back to basics a little bit on that. And I also think that they'd be very disappointed in not putting any pressure at all on Sean O'Brien's book out. So, like, Waterford were hugely impressive, were exceptional, but they got a little bit of a free ride that I don't think they're going to get over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, I just feel like I can't have a conversation about the top teams in the country and not have all the information, and I feel like I don't have all the information about Limerick, but as you said, we will in the next few weeks. So just on Waterford, and like you mentioned Stephen Bennett there, and to see a player like him do what he does, it's pretty phenomenal, Niall.
Yeah, he's class. He's class. And it's taken him, look, it's the last under Liam Cahill, you could really argue that he's really flourishing. I suppose he's been kind of put in as the main guy. Look, again, but he's surrounded by top forwards, like, you know what I mean? Patrick Curran, Desi Hutchison, like, you know, Jack Prendergast is very, very sharp. Austin Gleeson to come back in. So, like, that takes huge pressure off him. And for Waterford, if one or two forwards don't perform, but to have a lot of other guys step in at a very high level. And like, so look, again, like, Liam has a huge artillery of kind of options in front of him, but I suppose then there's probably challenges coming for Waterford now that mightn't have been there. Like, they are the most talked about team here over the last month. Mm-hmm. And like, which even with due respect to ourselves in Limerick, like, Waterford, like, the arrow seems to be on their back there at the moment. I suppose for Liam, even as a manager, he's probably facing a new challenge in the sense that he was so successful with those Tipperary under 20 and 21 teams, but they were coming off the back of failure in the Munster final, and I suppose he had a great stick to beat them with. And I suppose maybe now over the coming weeks and months, maybe the psychology of dealing with success will be a bigger problem. And to be fair to Waterford, I know they played it down on yesterday and on Saturday, they made no bones about trying to, it's all about championship and all about championship, but you have to realise, like, they won a huge competition, and they won a huge competition Saturday night, and there's a lot of players in a lot of other counties in their own county who never got the opportunity to win it. So trying to find that balance between actually savouring the fruits of your labour whilst kicking on for home is kind of a tricky balance, and I think that's where somebody like Caroline Kerr has played a huge role in Limerick, and I would imagine there's somebody of similar ilk in Waterford, and they will have probably a huge role as much as the coaches on the pitch over the coming weeks.
Yeah, that's for sure. I think the word there is expectation, Niall, and there's a huge amount of it on Waterford and Kerry, as Barry Cahill pointed out a little bit earlier too. Niall, thank you so much for joining us. A bit like Barry too, the next time we'll be talking show, we'll be chatting in championship. It is time for us to say goodbye, but first of all, we do have a competition winner, that FIFA competition. So the question was, which team are currently top of the English Premier League? The answer is Man City, and today's winner is Paula Devitt.